From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's Election Day. Millions of Americans are expected to add their votes to the record over 100 million already cast. Lots of excitement out there. We're touching down around the country. Let's go now to the swing state of Arizona, where Jimmy Jenkins of member station KJZZ is at a polling station in downtown Phoenix. So, Jimmy, what is turnout like, and what's the mood there?
Hey, Robin. Mood is positive. I've met a lot of first-time voters this morning. It's a lot of young people who really wanted that experience of coming out to the polls. We're close to the ASU downtown campus and Phoenix's urban core here, where a lot of young folks live. And all of them said they were impressed with how quick the process was. They said they felt safe and were excited to be here. And all of them Biden voters so far, Robin, that I've spoken with. Mm-hmm.
Well, but you also have a great, exciting Senate race there with the Republican Martha McSally being challenged by the Democrat Mark Kelly. Are people mentioning that as something that's pulling them to the polls?
Yeah, I think the Senate race is definitely driving turnout. There's also a few big down-ballot races that are driving turnout in Maricopa County. There we have a sheriff's race, a big prosecutor race. Both those offices, some of the biggest in the nation, both houses of our state house are seen to be in play for the Democrats for the first time in a long time. So state Senate and state rep races are really driving people out, as well as the congressional race.
Right. We have to remember those down ballot races. So when do you think we can expect to see results from this state? It's such a strongly contested one this year.
Well, we should have close to 1.6 million early votes counted by 8 p.m. out of 2.6 million ballots cast. But, Robin, you know, it took 5 days after Election Day to decide our last Senate race. So election officials here are just urging patience.
Yeah, because that's how it works. We keep counting till every ballot is counted. Jimmy Jenkins of member station KJZZ at a polling station in downtown Phoenix. Thank you.
You're welcome, Robin.
And let's turn now to the campaigns. This morning on Fox and Friends, President Trump predicted he'd win more electoral college votes than he did in 2016. Remember, that's how he won that race. And when asked when he'd declare victory, the president said this.
Only when there's victory. I mean, you know, there's no reason to play games.
Last night, Joe Biden, who's been ahead in most polls, also predicted victory.
And folks, I have a feeling we're coming together for a big win tomorrow.
Joining us now, NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Franco, what has each candidate made this race about? Remind us in these closing days.
It's ending very much like it started, especially for Trump, who has been, you know, very high volume with a lot of personal attacks against Joe Biden and other opponents. You know, he has really tried to capture the spirit and energy of his 2016 campaign with these massive rallies and basically continuing to downplay the surging virus that has killed over 230,000 Americans. Biden, meanwhile, has turned the focus of his campaign on making this a referendum on Trump, on Trump's policies, and particularly his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. But both sides say this is a historical election, and most Americans would agree that this election will have dramatic impacts on the future direction of the country.
Yep. And this morning, White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany injected another storyline. She claimed that the story of this election is that the Latino and Black vote came to President Trump. Both campaigns have targeted those voters, suburban women as well in key states. You know, in every election, we talk about last-minute swing voters. Have there been shifts that you're picking up on?
Yeah, we'll know for sure when the ballots are counted, but there is no question at all that both campaigns have made their pitches to Black and Latino voters. The Latino vote's going to be key in tight races in Arizona and Florida, and polls do show Trump is doing slightly better with Latinos than he did in 2016. I myself traveled to South Florida, where Trump's message against socialism kind of resonates with a lot of Cuban-American and Venezuelan-American voters because of what's occurred in their home countries and their parents' home countries. You know, and as for the African-American community, Trump has gotten some notable endorsements from some high-profile rappers for his pitch to Black voters. And after getting only 8% of the Black vote in 2016, he's trying to make some gains this time.
I'll just ask you quickly. Last night, Twitter and Facebook flagged President Trump's posts claiming that the late counting of mail-in votes in Pennsylvania was very dangerous, would lead to rampant fraud. There's no evidence of fraud, and ballot counting always goes on past Election Day, always. But what are the campaigns saying? What's next if there's no clear winner tonight and people are still counting?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, President Trump, you know, this weekend did make some comments about sending in the lawyers and taking action. But, you know, like the clip you just played, he's kind of backing off of that, saying there's no reason to play games. But both sides have amassed an army of lawyers in the event of a contested election. You know, the parties have been here before. We've seen this happen in 2000, and no one wants to get caught flat-footed.
Nope. NPR's Franco Ordonez, thank you.
Thank you.
And as the candidates make their closing arguments, the pandemic continues to dominate the campaigns. The Washington Post reports Dr. Deborah Birx, coordinator of the White House task force, has privately pleaded with the Trump administration to do more to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Dr. Birx is also saying that testing is flat or declining in many areas where cases are rising. And that's in contrast to President Trump, who has repeatedly blamed the latest surge in cases on more testing. Jennifer Nuzzo joins us now to talk more about that. She's a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Doctor, what's true? Are we doing more or less testing now than we were earlier in the year? And what impact is this having on case counts and positivity rates?
Compared to where we started in the spring, we're doing a lot more testing now every day. So it's certainly true that we are doing now more testing, but it is not true that this additional testing that we're doing is the sole explanation for why we're seeing more cases now. And the way that we know this is that we look at test positivity, or the percentage of people tested who come back positive. And if that number is increasing as it is right now, what that means is that the number of cases that we've seen, the number of people who are getting infected, have outpaced our efforts to expand testing. So basically, more people are getting sick at a faster rate than we have been able to expand testing.
I want to talk with you, though, about some of the places where it might be still difficult to get a test. Where are you still seeing spots where people possibly can't get a test if they want one?
Well, I think this is probably happening all over the place. And one of the challenges that we have in trying to track testing throughout the country is that we don't really have as granular enough data in order to be able to spot some of these access issues. Really, what we want to know is not just what's happening at the state level, but what may be happening in individual communities. Where we've been able to get data at, say, a county level, we see that not everybody has the same level of access to testing, which is problematic. Because if you only look at what's happening at the state level, you might be thinking that the state is just fine. But if you live in a community where it's very hard to find a place to be tested, you may be feeling a much different experience.
There's also the issue of paying for tests. So when it comes to who pays for COVID tests, it often depends on whether or not the test was ordered by a doctor or whether the person getting the test reports having symptoms. Do insurers cover the cost if the patient takes a test without symptoms or without a doctor's order?
The first congressional legislation aimed at coronavirus, which was the Families First Coronavirus Act, I may have that name wrong, but anyway, what it was intended to do was to try to eliminate the cost of coronavirus testing. And essentially, it requires that insurers cover the cost of testing. But if you're someone who doesn't have insurance, that may leave you in the lurch. And also, even if you have insurance, it still potentially is up to your insurer to define what kinds of tests they'll cover and under what conditions they'll cover that testing. So they may only cover if you are experiencing symptoms. They may not cover if you know, want to understand, because maybe you went to a high-risk place, if you may have been infected while you're there. And so these potential for there to be loopholes or there to be gaps in coverage, I think, is an important disincentive that we really need to examine, because if our hope is that we will have more and more testing to try to find people who may be infected but don't know it, eliminating cost barriers is a really important thing for us to do.
And then there are these wait times. I mean, how long are people waiting on average? And is that number trending up or down?
So over the summer, there were painfully long wait times in many parts of the country. It was being reported that it would take a week or more to get test results back. It appears that that has gotten considerably better, which is an important, I think, step forward and important progress. I do worry for the coming weeks as we kind of move into flu season and the increased burden that there'll be on laboratories, what that will do to our wait time. But for now, it seems like it's gotten better.
I think you alluded to this earlier, but have tests gotten any more accurate than they used to be? What's the rate of false positives and false negatives, generally speaking?
Sure. So it depends on which test is being used. But in general, I think they're very accurate, and people should trust that if they get a positive result, that's something that they should act upon. There is, of course, with some of the more rapid tests, the concern that they may find fewer people positive. But there is, I think, increasing belief that the people that they miss may not be the most contagious people, and that perhaps they're better at finding who's contagious rather than who's just, may have been infected at some point. Mm-hmm. So I think on whole, the tests that are out there are functioning fairly well, and that people should trust the results that they provide.
That's Jennifer Nuzzo, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Are you looking for some comic relief from this election? If so, you might want to turn to David Sedaris. The humorist has picked his best essays from almost 30 years of work and published them in a new collection that's out today. It's called The Best of Me, and David Sedaris joins us now. Welcome.
Oh, hello. Thanks for having me.
What were some of the criteria you used to figure out what you call the best essays?
Well, it was originally just going to be an audio collection. So I chose things that I'd always looked forward to reading out loud. It was that simple.
That simple. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the story. So one of the essays, The Motherless Bear, generated the most anger from readers the first time around. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, a number of years ago, I started writing, I guess you could call them fables. I was substituting animals for humans. And I wrote one about a bear whose mother dies and who just goes around trying to elicit sympathy from people, talking about how her mother died, just so she can take extra food and she can, so she can harvest pity. And this bear winds up like in a wretched kind of small circus where it kind of wears a skirt and dances around and has all of its teeth pulled. And people are just furious. And I've never gotten so much hate mail. And the thing is that it was a fictional story. And a woman in England wrote and chided me. She said, "How dare you mock these intelligent and sentient creatures?"
Oh.
She demanded that I donate money to a bear rescue.
And you're like, fiction, okay. One thing you did not include, though, is the Santaland Diaries, the essay about your time as a Christmas elf that introduced you to many NPR listeners.
Yeah. Well, I think you're lucky if you have something that resonates with people. But I got to say, that thing, it never did a thing for me.
Mm.
The writing in the Santaland Diaries is really clunky to me. Mm. I can't bear it.
It's interesting what people love versus what you love.
Well, I often feel like saying to people, like, gosh, can't you see how that thing I had in the New Yorker a couple months ago is like 100 times better? And again, I'm grateful that I wrote something that people enjoyed. But because it was my choice what went into this book, I was so happy to exclude it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I actually excluded it, and I wanted its feelings to be hurt.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about it, yes. Well, many of these essays are about your family, of course, but in your introduction, you take issue with the phrase that friends are the family you choose.
Well, you hear that all the time now, and I feel for people who aren't accepted by their family or who just simply dislike their family. And I think it's great that they found a group of friends that they can share everything emotionally with. That's fantastic. I just wouldn't call it a family. To me, the thing about a family is that you can't choose it. It's mm-hmm. a hand that you're dealt, and you've got to play that hand. I really lucked out in that department. I mean, I'm crazy about my family.
You also take issue with people who read your essays and call your family dysfunctional.
I just feel that's a lazy word. And I can't tell you how many times I've been signing books and someone will say, "Oh, I love your dysfunctional family." And I'm really grateful that they bought a book, and I'm really grateful that they want it signed. But the second I hear that, my back goes up, and I say, what's dysfunctional about them? When you really think about dysfunction in a family, I mean, you're thinking, me anyway, I'm thinking incest, abuse, I'm thinking torture. I'm not thinking hiding bananas under the sink in your bathroom. That's just gently crazy at best.
Yeah, which your father did, which you wrote in the book that he actually did. You have some really humorous stories about your family in this collection. For example, the perfect fit about you and your sisters, Amy and Gretchen, shopping in Tokyo. What's it like to shop with your sisters?
Well, the problem is that, I mean, I went shopping with my sister Amy yesterday and tried on a blouse, okay? I mean, it wasn't, it was just clearly a blouse. And I'd suggested it for her, and she said, I don't know, you know, it's roomy. Why don't you try it on? Try it on. No one will know. And, you know, the buttons are on the wrong side, and it kind of came to my belt in the front and had a, you know, a Peter Pan collar.
Was it cute on you? That's the point, though.
I did consider it. But yeah, the point is that she can talk me into anything. And then I try to do the same to her. Clerks are delighted when they see us walk into a store together.
They know they're going to get a sale.
Yeah, it's pretty guaranteed. I mean, I have siblings who don't care to shop. And I have to say, I mean, I love them and I love spending time with them. But it's just easier to spend time with the shopping ones. Because I quit taking drugs, gosh, I guess it was like 20 years ago. I worried about that because my family, we've always taken drugs together. And it was just a beautiful way to spend time. I don't mean we weren't shooting up heroin. It was like LSD. And I mean, they'd be followed by everyday drugs, but the, you know, the main course
but this, yeah, these events,
was a psychedelic. Yeah. And when I quit taking drugs, I worried that I would, that I'd lost a very important way of connecting with my family. Mm. And because we fundamentally like each other, it works out fine. But, you know, it's easier in stores.
There are more serious topics in your book as well. Your mother's drinking, your sister Tiffany's suicide. What does writing these essays do for you in processing what I would say are traumas, but I don't know if you see it that way?
Well, it's never, writing's never been cathartic for me. It doesn't fix anything. It doesn't necessarily make me feel better, but it helps me make sense of my world. And sometimes something happens and I think, gosh, I'm going to need a long time to figure this out or to find a way to make it funny, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is that? Comedy is tragedy plus time. Mm-hmm. And I don't care to write something that's not funny, you know, that's not going to get some laughs. Like in the essay about my sister's suicide, my family went to the grocery store. We were on the coast of North Carolina, and we were in the produce department, and my brother took a bundle of parsley. And it was one of those stores where they moisturize, you know, the fruits and vegetables, so they're always damp. And he snuck up behind me, and he said, achoo, while he whipped the parsley through the air. So I just felt this spray mm-hmm. on the back of my arms and the back of my neck, and I thought that a stranger had sneezed on me. It was just such a good laugh in the story. Mm-hmm. You know, and it wasn't disrespectful to include it. I mean, I was just kind of showing how, you know, we still have to go on. But that's an especially good trick to play on people now with COVID, the parsley trick.
People might start fighting, though. That's kind of serious right there. It's funny, but not during COVID times. That's some...
No, you would do it to someone you know.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't recommend it to a stranger.
No. Before we started, you actually told us that you'd already walked 14,000 steps in your little tracker. Mm-hmm. You've been walking a lot lately during this pandemic. Any new discoveries as you walk through New York City?
It's interesting to be in the city without tourists. Mm-hmm. Because normally there'd be certain parts of town you would just avoid. Just because they would be clotted with people walking five abreast and taking pictures of everything. And those people aren't here. So that was interesting. Also, normally I felt like one out of every 500 people you passed on the street was crazy. And then it became one out of every two. Mm-hmm. And so I usually go out after midnight, in part because there's nobody out, except one night I was walking through Times Square and a man said, "Look at the clown." And I looked at what I was wearing and I thought, okay, it's a little bit strange. But then I followed his gaze and there was an actual clown. There's an actual clown with like purple hair and a clown suit on. And it was like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Man, I mean, when do you sleep?
I go to bed at around 3.
Okay.
And then, you know, get up at around 10. Partly it's because I want to wake up with 4 or 5 miles under my belt. Because you don't know what might happen, right? What if I woke up and somebody said, "You've got to get on this plane to Australia"? I had a perfect record, right? I have a Fitbit and an Apple Watch, and I had a perfect record on my Apple Watch for like, I don't know, 2 years. And then, meaning I filled in all my circles, and then I had to fly from Los Angeles to Australia, and I crossed the international date line, and I lost a day.
Oh my gosh.
And I had to start all over from scratch.
Yeah, you don't want to deal
with that again. So I live in fear of something like that happening. My record is 91,000 steps. That's 43 miles.
In a day?
In a day.
24 hours.
I started at midnight, and then I was with a friend, and then we came home at 6 in the morning, and we rested for a bit, and then went out again and came home for lunch, and then went out again and came home for dinner, and then went out again. And she and I can talk about that any time, day or night. Can we live every moment?
Absolutely.
91,000 steps.
Well, you know, of all the things of this lovely conversation, I am really inspired to charge up my Fitbit and get back out there again. Thank you, David.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
We're going to take a break from the big news here in the U.S., our election day, to go to Vienna, where 4 people are dead and more than a dozen wounded in what authorities are calling a terrorist attack in the Austrian capital. A gunman was killed by police, and Austria's interior minister says evidence gathered so far shows no indication there were other attackers. The BBC's Bethany Bell joins us from Vienna. Bethany, this started about 8 p.m. local time there. What happened?
It's something that has left the city of Vienna in a state of shock. I'm now outside a square where some of the shootings took place. The shootings took place in parts of town where there are lots of bars and restaurants. People were out on quite a warm evening, taking advantage of the last night of restaurants and bars being actually open before the coronavirus lockdown that's gone into implementation today. There were shootings in 6 different locations in the historic city of Vienna, some in little small windy streets, one very close to the city's main synagogue. I was talking just now to a young man who was out with his friends trying to have a pizza, and they say that he had never been as frightened in his life.
Well, you know, there have been sporadic attacks around the world, one in Canada in which someone was dressed in a Halloween costume and had a sword, and there may have been mental health issues. Do we have any indication what this was about?
The authorities are saying they believe this to have been an incident of Islamist terrorism. The gunman who was shot dead very close to where I'm standing now is somebody who has already faced a jail sentence for terrorist activities. He was jailed last year for trying to get to Syria to join Islamic State. And he was actually released from jail early in December last year because of his youth. He was only 20 years old.
Now, so the attacker was well known and had been released. What's the conversation in Vienna with this news?
I think at the moment there is still an enormous sense of shock and fear here, because Austria has quite, Vienna in particular, has quite a large Muslim minority. There are fears that this could make relations between them and the rest of the city very difficult. The Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, has urged people, he said that people should look beyond that. He said that this was an attack against a free society, but he urged people not to fall into the trap that he said the terrorists were trying to set for them, to divide people more. He said it was not about, it was violent extremism that was the enemy, not peoples of one religion or another country.
Very briefly, Bethany, do we know who the four who were killed were?
We don't have too many details yet. We know that there were two women, two men. We understand that at least one of the women may have been a waitress. But there are still a number of other people also in very critical condition in hospital. And the thoughts and prayers of many people here are with them. Mm.
The BBC's Bethany Bell in Vienna. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
As we wait to see who the next president is, one thing's for sure, their ability to pass legislation could come down to a few key congressional races. Democrats are expected to keep their majority in the House, while Republicans are fighting to retain their control of the Senate. So just a couple of minutes now with NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. Hi, Claudia.
Hi there.
And start with the big picture. First, the House Democrats won the majority in 2018. You know, they obviously want to hold on to that, but how much are they hoping to grow it?
They see the potential to pick up 5 to 10 seats, maybe more. They already hold more than 230 seats in this chamber of more than 430 lawmakers. And they see several red districts where they see a potential flip to blue around the country, from Virginia to Texas and elsewhere. And there's some estimates they could even pick up 15 seats or even more if we do see a blue wave, as some are predicting around the country.
And what about the Senate? Republicans now hold 53 seats, and people are well aware, you know, they have control. Do Democrats feel confident? I mean, there's been talk about flipping some seats, but do they think they can flip the Senate?
There is some confidence there that they could potentially flip control of this chamber. They would need to gain 4 net seats when it's all said and done. Or if Democrats can pull off a presidential win, that gives them a tiebreaker in the vice presidency. And plus, they'll need a net gain of 3 nights when everything is done. And there's 4 or 5 seats where Democrats feel especially confident. That includes Colorado, Arizona, North Carolina, even Maine. But they're also looking at a potential loss where a Democrat, Doug Jones, is facing an especially strong red wall in Alabama. He's facing retired college football coach there, Tommy Tuberville. But that all said and done, they're feeling pretty confident going into tonight.
Well, let's take a closer look at some of the other races. Georgia, interesting, because both of its Senate seats are up this year, usually reliably Republican. We saw, though, you know, the Democrats going there on the campaign trail. It's now considered a toss-up when it comes to the presidential race. So a little more about what's at stake there.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It's the only state to have these 2 Senate races. One is a special election. And yes, this has been a long time red stronghold. And now we're talking about it as if it's a potential swing state. We're looking at one senator who was appointed to the seat, Kelly Loeffler, and she's facing off against another Republican for that seat. That's Representative Doug Collins. And they are facing off against Democrats, one especially strong figure. His name is Reverend Raphael Warnock. He is part of a church that Martin Luther King Jr. Was also part of, a very iconic Ebenezer church there in the Atlanta area. So that is one race that has drawn a lot of attention. Loeffler has drawn some negative attention for dumping about $20 million in stocks after attending a closed-door briefing on coronavirus back in January. She's rejected any of the claims against her there. And Doug Collins himself, he figured largely during the House impeachment trial, defended Trump fervently during that time. And now Loeffler, however, has become a big Trump ally. So that's going to be quite the battle there. In another race, Senator Perdue is facing off against John Ossoff. And this is a figure who fought a very expensive race, special election in 2017 for a House district and lost. But they feel like they have a better chance this time around to have a sweep and have both these Democrats come in and win these Senate races. So it's going to be something that folks are going to be watching closely tonight.
Yeah, adding to all the excitement. In South Carolina, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham is facing a fierce challenge from the Democrat Jamie Harrison, who's, you know, we've been reporting shattered congressional fundraising records. Graham, you know, was a Trump critic before he was a Trump defender. What are you watching there?
So that is so interesting. Harrison himself did set a record for raising the most money for any candidate for Senate in history. This was $57 million he raised in the third quarter. Lindsey Graham himself raised $28 million during that same quarter, which is a record for Republicans. And Graham is a longtime figure, a political figure for the state. He's become a very close ally to President Trump. He was not such a fan at the beginning, but that has changed. And that's part of the controversy that Graham has drawn, is that he has switched positions so much since the beginning of Trump's term. And so that's brought him some criticism. However, South Carolina has been a red stronghold, and it would be quite the upset if Harrison can pull that off.
Well, in only the minute we have, you know, you're kind of raising the specter of the down ballot concern that there was, that Trump would affect people down ballot. Is that, you know, what you're seeing, that it's some people who maybe voted for Trump in 2016, if they don't support him now, might vote blue all the way down the ballot?
That's very possible. We're seeing more word of voters basically voting straight tickets, voting blue or voting red. So it's very possible we see these voters who have broken away from Trump going completely blue come today and in the coming days as they count these ballots.
Okay, you've given us a lot to think about as we watch the returns tonight. It's the down ballot races as well that are, you know, pretty darn exciting. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
President Trump has strong support from white evangelical voters who like his policies that restrict access to abortion, and not just in the United States. The Trump administration has put in place anti-abortion rules that now affect some $12 billion a year in global health aid around the world. And as Sarah Varney reports, that comes with consequences for women's health, including access to contraception.
For nearly five decades, U.S. foreign aid money hasn't paid for abortions in other countries, no matter who is in the White House. And since Ronald Reagan, Republican presidents have barred foreign aid organizations from using U.S. global health funds to counsel women about abortion or refer them to a safe abortion provider. The Trump administration followed that precedent and added even more rules. Here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, a longtime evangelical, talking recently to the Florida Family Policy Council.
Our administration has drawn on our first principles to defend life in our foreign policy like no administration in all of history. Look no further than our unprecedented defense of the unborn abroad.
What the Trump administration did was vastly expand the anti-abortion restrictions to nearly every facet of global health, to groups that work on HIV, malaria, tuberculosis, and water sanitation. And that's not all. Any group that takes U.S. global health dollars is also forbidden from accepting money from anyone else if that money is going to pay for abortion counseling or referrals. Jeannie Mancini is president of the March for Life Education and Defense Fund. She says she's glad President Trump is advancing anti-abortion goals worldwide.
Someone in Africa or Scandinavia doesn't have any less human dignity than a person in the United States.
But researchers from Johns Hopkins and AMFAR, the Foundation for AIDS Research, found the policy has interrupted access to contraception, pregnancy counseling, and HIV testing. Providers have been forced, they say, to choose between the largesse of U.S. funding and mentioning abortion at all. AMFAR's Jennifer Sherwood surveyed 280 healthcare providers in dozens of countries to see how the Trump policies affected their work. She says, unlike the U.S., in Africa, it's young women who face the highest risk of HIV, and many clinics had combined HIV testing and treatment with family planning services. But fearing they would run afoul of the Trump policy and forfeit funding, clinics have curtailed family planning for patients.
a lot of the times they, you know, they want contraception. That's what's on their mind. And HIV is sort of the secondary thing that we can tack on to that visit and serve all their needs at once.
In Madagascar, abortion is illegal with no exceptions. And yet the Trump policy has still had an impact on reproductive health. The largest provider of contraception in Madagascar refused to comply with the Trump policy and turned down U.S. money. Its staff feared they could no longer offer unfettered medical care to women. Mom Razafimahatra is a researcher at the National Public Health Institute in Madagascar. He says that's led to shortages of contraception in a poor country where travel to nearby towns is difficult.
The women asked us, what is the cause of this rupture? It's then that we try to explain to them the reason, and they say, but that regulation is for abortion, so we don't understand why we are also penalized.
The future of this policy hinges on the upcoming presidential election. Opponents call the policy the global gag rule, and former Vice President Joe Biden has said he would rescind it on his first day in office. For NPR and Kaiser Health News, I'm Sarah Varney.
So, Tanya, last night I pulled my car in my driveway and forgot to shift into park.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, destroyed.
So much on your mind.
I know. I think we're all preoccupied. Waiting on news like election returns combines two unpleasant states, uncertainty and powerlessness, and that adds up to torture.
Yeah, that's how Charlie Warzel describes it. He wrote a piece in the New York Times. He's an opinion writer at large, and he joins us now with some tips about reducing our anxiety. Charlie, welcome and happy Election Day.
Thanks for having me.
So you spoke with a number of experts who explain why this moment is so agonizing. One psychologist even described it as being strapped into a roller coaster as it climbs up a hill, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. Why is waiting bringing us so much anxiety? I have a few ideas, but I want to hear from you.
Well, you know, this is a situation in which we actually don't have a ton of agency beyond voting. And obviously, it's Election Day. Go out and vote if you haven't. That is something you can do. You can help people, you know, at the polls. You can provide emotional support. But broadly speaking, this election is something in which we are, you know, one piece of a very large machine, and we kind of can't stop it. And that's sort of why the roller coaster metaphor works so well. You've gotten into the ride, and it's going to happen whether you like it or not. So that lack of agency is really where our brains start to go into overdrive, and we ruminate, is what all the psychologists told me. And that's just, we chew over the same thoughts, and that just leads to building anxiety.
Or not putting your car in park, which I did. And you quote Mother Jones editor-in-chief Clara Jeffrey, who said the entire country is awaiting a biopsy result. I mean, that tension of not knowing the outcome. But you also say some people choose defensive pessimism, like, okay, I'm not even going to build myself up for disappointment. There's no way that this can win. But others brace for the worst, and there's a difference. What's the difference?
So this is the biggest insight that I got speaking to a bunch of professionals here. Defensive pessimism is a tactic that we employ in situations where we have a lot of agency. So take, for example, like a big test coming up. You say, oh, I'm not ready, I'm going to fail. And that actually tricks your brain into studying more. So you actually take more action. But in a situation like this, where we don't really have agency, there's not much more besides the voting that we can do, it actually sends us into this spiral. And so what you end up feeling is you end up feeling bad in the beginning, and it doesn't actually protect you emotionally if you get the bad news later. So you're basically setting yourself up for two valleys of disappointment, potentially, rather than just one. So in this case, bracing for the worst, preparing yourself to say, okay, if the news that I don't want comes to pass, what am I going to do? What, you know, how am I going to take care of myself? But then remaining optimistic is actually a way to save yourself two disappointments, and it's a little bit better.
You know, it's sort of counterintuitive, because oftentimes we might say to each other, I'm going to just expect the worst so I'm not disappointed. So this way of thinking kind of goes against the way human nature works. So as we wait for results, regardless of the outcome, what can we do to stay sane?
Well, This actually speaks to what a lot of the psychologists told me, which is we are always sort of undermining our best interest. Our brains are always kind of working against that. So one thing that you can do is you might feel tempted in the next, you know, days or hours to cancel a lot of plans, to just sort of stay with the news, whatever happens, follow it obsessively. But staying busy is actually the best thing that we can do. When we're just sort of passively consuming the news, it allows us to do that rumination and sort of chew over the thoughts again. So don't cancel plans, actually schedule plans. And that's tough in a pandemic, but if you can, you know, find people to talk to at least, or if you do have, say, that doctor's appointment, don't put it off. That's one thing that you can do. Another thing that you can do is to find something that is small but meaningful that you can look forward to today. Say, I'm going to go out and get my favorite sandwich or cook my favorite meal or watch my favorite episode of my favorite TV show.
Ordering a cake today.
Exactly.
Boy, Charlie, this is such a reminder of why people who actually plan something for this day related to elections, like they volunteer, you know, they go to another state where their work might, you know, have more of an impact than in the state they live in. They plan to be involved civically, and we always hear they feel much better because at least they were doing something. I just want to mention, as we close here, you also quoted Kate Sweeney, who's a noted professor of psychology, University of California, Riverside, quite the academic, and she had perhaps the most scientific observation, which is if you feel like crap, you're not alone. You know, just the notion of, as you said, call somebody.
That's right. The day might mean different things for different people, but nobody isn't experiencing this day today. And you can take solace in that. So find a buddy, find a loved one, communicate your thoughts, don't bottle them up, and hope for the best. Be optimistic.
Charlie Warzel is an opinion writer for the New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, Robin, do you have your day planned?
Yes, I have to take my car to the repair shop. And you?
Oh, I'll have every TV on in the house while doom scrolling. I can't do anything else. It's just in me.
Doom scrolling.
Yes. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.